So, the way we do it at Root & Branch, if this is your first time, is we've almost always had two readings. One is typically from the Bible, it's always been from the Bible, and the other one is not from the Bible. And so, Jessica's going to do our biblical scripture reading for tonight.
All right. Yes, I am. All right, so the reading is from John 20, verses 19 through 31. Starts, when it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and the doors of the house where the disciples had met were locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing you may have life in his name.
Thank you. And Devin,
want to
come on up?
Oh, yeah, good.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And I should just say that one of the ideas of having a reading that's not from the Bible is, at least the way I think about it, is to make the point that the way we tend to read scripture here is that it's sacred and that it can help awaken us to the sacred in our lives, but that we also don't think that that's the only place where sacredness is found or the only text that can open us to God. And in fact, I think to read it is to sort of, in some ways, insult God, in some ways insult the sacred, that it's like only stuck in this one spot. So that's why we do this.
So I found this on the internet, surfing. I've read a few books by Carl Sagan, and this is his daughter writing on what he had taught her about death. So this is from her, an excerpt from Lessons of Immortality and Mortality from my father, Carl Sagan, by Sasha Sagan. It says, "One day when I was still very young, I asked my father about his parents. I knew my maternal grandparents intimately, but I wanted to know why I'd never met his parents. Because they died, he said wistfully. Will you ever see them again, I asked? He considered his answer very carefully. Finally, he said that there was nothing he would like more in the world than to see his mother and father again, but that he had no reason and no evidence to support the idea of an afterlife, so he couldn't give in to the temptation. So she asked, why? And he told me, very tenderly, that it can be dangerous to believe things just because you want them to be true. You can get tricked if you don't question yourself and others, especially people in a position of authority. He told me that anything that's truly real can stand up to scrutiny. As far as I can remember, this is the first time I began to understand the permanence of death. As I veered into a kind of mini existential crisis, my parents comforted me without deviating from their scientific worldview. You are alive right this second, and that is an amazing thing, they told me. When you consider the nearly infinite number of forks in the road that lead to any single person being born, they said, you must be grateful that you're you at this very second. Think of the enormous number of potential alternate universes where, for example, your great-great-grandparents never meet and you never come to be. Moreover, you have the pleasure of living on a planet where you have evolved to breathe the air, drink the water, and love the warmth of the closest star. You're connected to the generations through DNA and even further back to the universe, because every cell in your body was cooked in the hearts of stars. We are star stuff. And that was like his famous line in all of his books. And he made me feel that.
Thanks to our readers. That's beautiful. So Devin's not lying. I chose that text because he had posted it on his Facebook or like shared it or liked it or whatever the kids say. And I read it was just a part of a much longer piece by Sasha, his daughter, that was really beautiful. And I sort of knew a little bit about Carl Sagan. I knew that he kind of had almost a mystical, almost religious devotion to the pursuit of scientific knowledge. And so I thought it was cool, but I thought it was also cool because it's sort of seems on the face of it to be very different from the first passage, from the passage where there's this sort of visible, in-your-face proof or evidence that death is not the end. And here he is struggling with how to make sense of this question that his daughter asks him about that. So what I want to suggest is that there's more similarities going on than might meet the eye, and that sort of reading them together might actually help us figure out what's going on in this crazy Bible passage that I'm convinced means something, but needs a little bit of needs something to be said about it. So the obvious sort of interpretation of this passage, you'll heard of Doubting Thomas. He's kind of a famous figure. This is where he appears. Is that it's about defining faith as faith being something that we hold to sort of blindly in spite of the lack of evidence for it. So Jesus says, fine, I'll show you, I'm real here, yeah, touch me, but blessed are those who believe and yet have not seen. So that's sort of the true, that's real faith. You guys are weak. Of course, it's sort of ridiculous because, and it's ridiculous that Thomas becomes known as Doubting Thomas because he was out, like, I don't know, grocery shopping or whatever, and like they all saw, you know, Jesus was there and like let them, you know, breathe on them and showed him, and then he's the one who's doubting just because he says I have to see it to believe it. Well, they've already seen it, but there's obvious. I want to suggest that that's actually not the main meaning of faith that's going on here. Or at least that's just one part of it, and that paying attention to who's seeing and what's being seen might help us. So when two people are standing face to face, as we get Jesus and Thomas doing, right? Jaden, you probably know this. If two people are looking at each other, who's seeing who? If I'm looking at you right now, who's seeing who?
Both.
Brilliant! Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what I think is going on here. I think that's something people sometimes miss, is that it's about Jesus like teaching these people what faith means by saying, you know, it's better if you just sort of, the people who didn't have to see. But really, I think what's interesting is like, Jesus is looking at Thomas, too. He's seeing Thomas. He's seeing the disciples. So you've got these people who are terrified. It says in the beginning they're afraid. They've locked all the doors. They're bunkered down because the person who showed them this radically new way of being together and living and loving and having hope again, and having hope that sort of the, all the little deaths in life, and then the big death at the end of life, kind of don't destroy or negate or take away the magic, the miracle of life, and the reasons to love. But now they're like, oh my gosh, it was all for nothing. None of that was real. It was sort of a nice thing. It was like something we sort of told ourselves or we believed in, but it was a sort of fantasy. Because look, real life comes in and kills the hope. And they're freaking out. I know, exactly. It's scary. That's right. He gets it. He's with me. So you know, one thing. Well, here's proof. There is hope. I'm here. See, touch me. Help you. But what I'm interested is what Jesus is doing. Is that he's seeing them. He's witnessing them in this place of fear, in this place of uncertainty, of like not just doubt in a kind of epistemological, like scientific sense. I'm not sure if there is life after death, but this kind of existential, this belly core doubt, does any of this matter? And he's seen them in that spot, and he's saying, I see you, and you know what? I'm gonna give you something direct that that makes you know that you're seen in that spot. So let's go to the Carl Sagan piece for a second. I'm going to come back to this because I think it'll help us understand it. In this beautiful recollection we get from his daughter, she's recalling asking him this question: where's Grandma and Grandpa? And it's sort of her first understanding that, like, they're gone, they're not around. And he's struggling with how do I stay true to what I believe as a scientist, or what I, you know, which is this sort of evidence-based way of thinking, but also see and respond to what my daughter's going through. So, you know, one, I can imagine a couple of responses to different, I'm trying to think, what would I do if my kid asked me this? And I could imagine a couple of responses. One would be, hey, look at this toy, or like, you know, like kind of change the subject, or oh, don't worry about it, it's all good, or kind of, you know, brush it off. But what's so incredible, and which I think makes him an amazing parent, amazing father, is that he sees that what his daughter's going through is something really real, something really serious, and something that can't be brushed off. And he sees that it's something that he needs to devote his kind of his entire attention, his entire sort of training as a human to this. So what I think he does is he gives her two gifts in that moment that Devin just read. The first gift is that sort of attention of seeing her in her weakness, in her fear, in her uncertainty. And simply being there and acknowledging that it's real and sort of saying, I see you in this, that's that right there, I think, is a gift. But the other gift he gives her is this remarkable thing that somehow outlasts his ability to be there with her. That somehow, by talking about, in this rhapsodic, beautiful, poetic way, about this multiverse theory of physics, you know, the universe could have turned out this way or this way or this way, and at every moment there's another universe that's possible. Somehow, through all those possibilities, this one is here, and you're in this one, and this one is inhabitable. You can breathe here. You can feel the warmth of the sun here. You can drink here. And then the other way is that you're literally made out of the stars. So in that first, that weird multiverse thing, it sounds, you know, at first glance that he's giving a kind of neutral sort of description of physics, the way physics works. But what he's really doing is this kind of amazing thing where he's saying, I know it's totally improbable, and the fact that it's this improbable almost makes it more special, but you're supposed to be here. Like, he's not saying it explicitly, but the effect of that sort of, this brilliant scientist saying, all of this entire universe somehow led up to you. I can imagine someone telling me that. I mean, that makes me feel like somehow in the midst of this vastness, this coldness, potentially, it led to me. Somehow this unimaginably enormous thing beyond all my comprehension is, in a way, taking care of me because I can live here. I can breathe here. I can feel the sun here. And then the second thing, that you're made of the stuff of stars, you're made of star stuff. I mean, you know something like that?
Huh?
Were you going to say something?
I knew that you're made out of tiny star stuff, like you're made out of star things, and every time there's like these little like stuff, like there's something on your finger, like something on your hands that help you touch and stuff, like everything like that.
So somehow, like, you mean even like when we feel this stuff, it's almost like stars are helping us or something,
mm-hmm.
helping us feel. I like that. That's really cool. I think that's exactly right, Jaden. I think what he's telling his daughter is not this sort of neutral theory again of physics, like, you know, you technically are made out of, you know, they didn't know about the Higgs boson, but like muons and gluons and protons and, you know, and so are stars technically, so you're kind of technically made of the same stuff. He's saying this thing that is, that you feel awe at when you look up in the sky at night, when you're sort of overcome with how big things are and how little you are, but how beautiful that is, that's you. So when you're looking at this thing that fills you with awe, somehow it's reflected back at you, and that's looking at you. Like, the stars are you. The stars made you. You're as amazing as the stars. And I'm seeing that, and in a way, the whole universe is seeing that. So I think what needs to be said there is that Carl Sagan starts it off by saying, I need evidence to believe, so I don't have evidence for life after death. And he kind of gives this, but what's so incredible is that through sort of a description of what he can see, of what is already there, he actually invokes some, I would say, very life-affirming, life-saving things, and he actually also invokes, maybe in spite of himself, some things that we don't have evidence for, but he clearly believes in. He clearly believes in that this little pattern of matter that assembled to be his daughter is so important. It's somehow so important that he needs to make her feel how important she is and show her that love, and that. These things like awe, the human feeling of awe, or the human feeling of love and care, those are really real things too. You can't necessarily account for them in a strictly materialist way, but they're real and they're worthy of our attention. So I think in some ways this is a way that I can make sense of this story, this crazy story of Jesus' resurrection, or at least I can sort of fill out and make it touch my life, is that there's this crazy claim in Christianity that somehow God has a human face, and that this human body that's appearing to these scared people is both a human moment of touch and attention, but it's also something that even when Jesus is gone, or the sort of state we're all in where we don't have that direct attention, that something really fundamental and real about the sort of fabric of things, the fabric of everything we can conceive, is also seeing us, and is also seeing us when we're afraid, and is also there with us and caring for us. So, in a way, that's one way that I can kind of make sense of this Christian claim that in some ways seems sort of exclusivist. It can say, you know, saying that God had to sort of enter human history. It can sound like before Jesus came, you didn't have that kind of love, or in other religions, they don't have it. Jesus, but the way I make sense of that claim is that maybe actually to feel that kind of that love and that presence that is there even when no one's telling us, maybe we actually do need a human being to tell us that. So that maybe Jesus had to kind of get this thing rolling. Like you needed someone like Carl Sagan to be there, to be the one to awaken this feeling in people. The other thing about Christianity that sort of is fascinating from a historical perspective is that it really was, at the time, a pretty radical thing to say that not just people in your family, not just people who look like you, not just people who speak the same language or worship the same, you know, do the same rituals as you, that they're also all worthy of being seen. That was a pretty radical thing to say at the time. I think it's still pretty radical. Okay, so some of you may have met this guy, but I have a friend who I've known since 10th grade. His name is Tom. And he and I became friends ever since 10th grade French class, when we would sort of not really pay attention and talk and make really... Did anyone make video projects in high school? Like, everyone can relate to this. So, you know, and did anyone have the experience of, like, making a horrible video project that was really just goofy and somehow that counted for school credit? Like, I hope they still do that for the sake of the kids, but it's ridiculous that was real. But so Tom and I made a lot of video projects together. And Tom and I were really different. Tom was an introvert, I'm more of an extrovert. Tom is really analytical and sort of very rational, one of the most rational people I know. He won the high school debate competition. He was of America, like the US, whatever, the tournament of champions. He was the best high school debater in the country, and he was my best friend. And I like to argue with him and stuff, but I'm much less sort of cool-headed and rational. I'm more of like impulse kind of, it just feels right, or I saw this thing, or I heard this thing. And so we would have, but the amazing thing is that we worked really well together as friends, and we got along, and we could each be kind of who we were, and somehow we still liked that. So the, you know, as these friendships tend to do after high school, we kind of grew apart during college. We would try to visit each other, but, you know, it became harder. We kind of, our lives were going different directions, living in different cities. And in the past few years, that distance has kind of increased even more. And at first I was like, oh, I guess that's just what happens when you're becoming this old, that's sad. But I think I also started to realize that maybe it had something to do with our lives taking a kind of more radical turn, which is that I suddenly went to divinity school. I was suddenly kind of a religious person, and I was starting a church. And for Tom, I mean, this is an experience I had with a lot of friends and family of sort of surprise, amusement, confusion, but then, okay, you know, that's cool, like, we're done with that. But for Tom, it was, I think, I kind of sensed that it was a little more of a sort of bump he couldn't get over, that it was something that, like, he was just a little too reasonable, a little too materialist for this to really make sense, and never said anything, you know, but we would, you know, have kind of abstract philosophical conversations or then kind of change the subject. So I think, you know, in a way, his lack of understanding or really getting why I was doing this made me a little less likely to be open, be spontaneous, be just kind of call him up. And then, to be totally honest, I think I maybe felt a little bit the same way about his decision to go to law school. I was kind of like, all right. Maybe in high school we would have these conversations about how we want to change the world and you know, how things were so messed up. And I kind of maybe deep down thought a little bit like, well, maybe Tom just really wants sort of a life of like material comforts, and that's, you know, that's fine. He was always he kind of liked his video games, we all like comfort, right? So, but I was like, maybe he gave up. Anyways, it was sort of distant. So a few months ago, about 2 months ago, Tom called me and he said, hey, can I stay with you when I'm in Chicago for this conference? And I was like, of course, that'd be wonderful. But I realized it was the first Sunday worship of Root and Branch that weekend. And well, he's like, oh, that's cool. Like, I'm probably leaving Sunday morning anyways. Did Jaden, you want to say something real quick? Can you wait 1 second and then I'll come back to you? Awesome, thanks. Almost done. He's sensing. So basically, he's like, oh, that's cool. I'm leaving Sunday morning anyways. I won't be in your hair. I was like, okay, that's good. Because I was a little relieved because I was like, well, I don't know. Tom isn't so sure about this stuff anyways. Maybe seeing it would be just more awkward. And then he called me back about a week later and said he had changed his travel plans because he really wanted to see Wooden Branch. He wanted to be there. And then I was like a little nervous, but okay, we'll make the best of it. Long story short, Tom not only came, but he helped Tim and I when we were staying up really late the night before, like doing random last minute tasks. He took photos and he wrote me this amazing email saying how impressed he was and how if he were in Chicago, he would come. And, you know, of course he didn't say that, but then on top of that, he called me a couple days later and he had this list of things that it was so sweet. They were like suggestions. Like, okay, I've got this idea. So when you're doing the prayer thing, you've got to, you have a secret cue so the band knows when this slide comes up that they should start slowing down the song and then it'll be like a smoother transition. He's like, another idea. Like, this is how you could conceptualize, like, okay, people want community and because they're doing that. This is how you think about justice. He just had all these ideas about the church and it was just overwhelming. I felt so, not just like supported, but like he really saw what we were doing and really thought it mattered and like didn't want to just give me the sense of that. He really cared. So you know, one lesson is like show your whole thing to your friends and you'll feel this love. But actually, I think the lesson is that Tom always cared about that. Tom changed his flight, his travel plans so he could come. It was my sort of doubt about myself and about this stuff that was kind of making the relationship weird. We'll see if he gets a job here someday, if he puts his money where his mouth is. But the point is that weird distance was gone, and we were talking about all kinds of stuff, like his baby that's on the way and my, you know, my love life, like just everything was sort of, it was all back. It was all back. So I have a takeaway. You know, sometimes my sermons tend to be a little bit like in the air, but I had this idea for a just very direct thing we can do in our lives, or thing we can think, is I would just encourage everyone to think about the people in their lives, people they're already close to, but also just people you encounter in the world, and think, how can I help this person see that they're seen? How can I help this person know that they're known? And not just by me, not just sort of like, oh, I love you, and so you're loved, but I love you because you're just incredibly lovable and loved already. Like, what are the things we can do in our lives? So that would be, and then just tell them, like, believe it. You have to just believe it.